I'm Christopher Blyton. This is Open Source. In the first of a series we're calling In Search of Monsters, The Rise and Fall of American Empire, in collaboration with the Quincy Institute, nudging all of us to rethink what we're doing in this 21st century. Time travel with us this hour, back 50 years to the spark that renewed China and began a remapping of the human story. Here was the American president, Richard Nixon, warming up to China in February 1972.
We join the Chinese people, we the American people, in our dedication to this principle that never again shall foreign domination, foreign occupation, be visited upon this city or any part of China or any independent country in this world. Mr. Prime Minister, our two peoples tonight hold the future of the world in our hands.
Our guest, Chaz Freeman, was there that whole week between Richard Nixon and China's chairman Mao Zedong, interpreting one to the other in Beijing and noting odd details at a sharp turn of history. Mrs. Nixon's knockout red coat, for example. Make of it what you will, the Chinese-American novelist Gish Jin calls her new story collection Thank You, Mr. Nixon, especially for that red coat. Chaz Freeman, you were in on all of it. Is it fair to say that week in Beijing changed more lives in more ways than anything we remember watching?
I think you're right. We knew it was an historic moment. We didn't understand that it was really a hinge of history and opened all sorts of doors that were closed and let things out that we didn't know about.
Chaz Freeman, what do you tell your grandchildren about those guys? Mao, Nixon, Kissinger, Zhou Enlai fascinates me.
Well, I never saw Mao because Nixon had the very bad practice of not using American interpreters for private discussions, either in Moscow or in Beijing, as it happened. But I saw a lot of Zhou Enlai, a lot of Nixon, and a lot of Kissinger, not just then, but later. This was a moment in my life in which I was essentially vindicated. I had wanted to join the Foreign Service precisely to be there when the United States and China reached out to each other, because I thought at the time the United States had no relationship with China. Russia had an alliance which had failed with China, and I thought the strategic geometry required the U.S. to reach out to China, and we did. So my prediction came true, and I was fortunate enough to be on the scene when it happened.
The guy I can't take my eyes off is Zhou Enlai. I want him on my team. Who was he, and how did he get there?
He was the son or the descendant of many generations of officials, a very sophisticated background. One thing I noticed at the time was, having seen the rival Chinese leadership in Taipei, the leadership in Beijing was from a much higher class background, ironically. He had gone to university. He was a famous actor for a while. He had a grace and charm about him that was irresistible. And, of course, what I had read about him remembered Dag Hammarskjöld, who was the first Secretary General of the UN, or maybe the second, a very sophisticated European, said that the only time in his life when he felt that he'd been in the presence of a more civilized man was when he met Zhou Enlai.
It's a different Nixon than where we remembered or even saw at the time. He's a strategist in office. When did we have something like that? He's bold. He's confident. He's awkward moving in a way, but he knows what he's doing. He speaks well without notes or prompter or anything. You say he had decided before he got elected in 68 that a world system that did not have China in the boardrooms could not be stable, and he was going to do something about it. And by gum, he did.
He wrote an article in Foreign Affairs, I think in 1967, saying pretty much that the world could not survive peacefully with an angry, isolated China, and it had to be brought in. Now, here's the interesting thing. Henry Kissinger, who was not a fan of Nixon at all, but a great expert on balance of power politics, who wrote probably, well, I don't say probably, I think it is the best book on 19th century European balance of power politics, It's called A World Restored.
Right.
It's about how Metternich, Kissinger's hero, I suppose.
Right, the man he wanted to be when he grew up.
Yeah, Metternich defanged the French Revolution and brought post-Napoleonic France into the councils of Europe rather than excluding them. He thus did something that kept the peace for a century. When, after World War I, the victors excluded both Germany and the Soviet Union from a role in the governance of Europe, we got World War II and the Cold War. So Nixon understood this history, I think. Kissinger certainly did. In the beginning, Kissinger was very skeptical about an opening to China. This was Nixon's initiative. He was a very strange man, obviously had many defects of character, which ultimately brought him down. But as you said, he should be remembered as a statesman. And I think in our history, you have to go back to John Quincy Adams to think of someone who had the realism, the imagination, the skill that Nixon brought to international relationships.
We'll come back to all of that and your line that the world is waiting for a new Nixon, that those men knew what they were doing and by and large did well. First, let's count the ways, though, in which that moment, 50 years ago exactly, changed everything. Among other things, from near starvation, China has become the workshop, maybe the sweatshop of the whole world. A third of all manufacturing on the planet happens in China, and a very big share of high-tech and science work, the workforce that does it, lives in China. A lot of people call it the downside that the U.S., which had half the world's manufacturing, now does a sixth of it. You count the ways that you see.
This opening to China that Nixon engineered was not intended to produce any of those results.
Strange.
It was a purely geopolitical maneuver to enlist China in the containment of the Soviet Union.
Exactly.
And it involved switching from the containment of China by Taiwan to the containment of the Soviet Union by Beijing. That was all. Yet, it proved to be the beginning of a process that really has altered not just China, but the world. China has become a very serious competitor in the capitalist economies of the world.
Right.
In fact, so serious a competitor that whereas in 1972 we were worried about Chinese weakness, vulnerability, and poverty, we're now worried about Chinese strength and prosperity. And as you suggested, concerned about the extent to which China, which in 1972 had no educational system to speak of because of the Cultural Revolution,
right,
has now got to the point where it's graduating 45 million college students a year.
Yeah. The rude question has to be asked, who got the better of all these surprises? The bargain to begin with, and then 50 years?
Well, I think both sides won, and that was important. China gained protection against the Soviet Union, which was on its borders and with which it had fought several times. The United States gained a counterweight to the Soviet Union that it needed at the time. In 1979, when the Soviet Union invaded and occupied Afghanistan, this relationship changed. It had been basically the United States treating China as a protected state, one of which we had no expectations, but whose survival and continued place in geopolitics we thought was essential. In 1979, the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan challenged both Chinese and American interests, and the relationship became an entente, that is, a limited partnership for limited purposes. We both had our programs of support for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan separately, but the Chinese supplied most of the weapons for our program, paid for largely by the Saudis. So this was a geopolitical partnership that was unthinkable in 1972. Later, as China, under Deng Xiaoping, used its American connection to reform, that is, Deng very carefully used the opening to the United States to re-educate Chinese and to change the system to get rid of the worst features of the Soviet system they had earlier adopt it and get rid of the features of Maoism that he detested. And as China opened up and reformed, joined the World Trade Organization, it emerged, as it is now, as you said, with an industrial economy twice the size of the United States, the world's greatest trading power, everybody's top trading partner, and now, amazingly, a great leader in science and technology. There is a mistaken view in the United States that Chinese progress in technology is all purloined from the West, but this is absolutely not the case. Huawei, the telecommunications company that we have set out to destroy, actually has by far the largest trove of patents for 5G and related communications in the world. So China has become self-sustaining, prosperous, relatively open. When we don't have pandemics, Chinese tourists clog all the tourist sites in Europe and the United States. This is a totally different situation from 1972.
Even from their wildest notions, as you say. But it was also the beginning, nobody used the word, but of globalization of everything. Did Kissinger see that? Did he want that? Did the Rockefeller sponsors of Kissinger from way back see this as a giant capitalistic opportunity? What were the seen and unseen consequences?
It's interesting because, of course, no one saw that. And the Chinese, being good Marxists, imagined that the United States was motivated largely by economic forces and a lust for trade with China. But we weren't at all. But I suppose the globalization that this began, which really took off with Deng Xiaoping's opening, was completely unforeseen. And it's had enormous consequences, much to the benefit of the United States, I should say.
Coming up, how unlike the Cold War with Russia was this U.S. link with China from Nixon's time even till today. This is Open Source. The Nixon-Mao summit of 50 years ago was the first star turn for our guest, Chaz Freeman, translator and interpreter at the start of an epic career in U.S. diplomacy. You know, I've been looking at old video clips of those meetings in Beijing, 1972. It's amazing how often the Americans and the Chinese talk about our friends, the Chinese, the great nation of China, always our friend, consistently our friend, etc. How did that feeling, or pretense even, fall apart?
The U.S.-China relationship has always been a roller coaster. We go from antagonism to camaraderie very easily, apparently. And of course, our image in the United States of China was of our benign influence, our help with the Chinese in the 1930s and 40s, our alliance against the Japanese in the 40s. I think on the Chinese side, this rhetoric of old friends and so forth is a courtesy. I don't think it was sincere. I think on our side, perhaps, it was also not sincere. These were politicians dealing with each other, and politicians value sincerity precisely because it's a very rare thing for them.
Charles, I'm just wondering, though, who read the future better? My first candidate would be Zhou Enlai, your sophisticated friend. Did he see this as an opportunity for radical capitalistic development?
I think Zhou Enlai was a very committed Marxist, very hard-bitten. He was a tough guy, despite the graceful manners and charm. Deng Xiaoping, by contrast, I think had a moment of revelation. He was let out of labor reform and sent to New York to the General Assembly in 1974. I was present when he met with Henry Kissinger, then the Secretary of State. And I was very impressed by him. He was quick. He cut through the nonsense and went straight to the point.
For example?
Just very realistic, you know, grasped ideas instantly. I came away with an impression of somebody who was really gifted at statecraft. On his way home, he stopped in Paris. Now, he had been in Paris as a student and as one of the founders of the Chinese Communist Party and a member of the French Communist Party in the beginning of the 20s. And he knew what Marxist theory predicted would happen in a capitalist society like France. So here he was, 1974, 50 years later, in Paris, and it bore no resemblance to what the predictions had been. It was a prosperous society in which the common people had benefited, not been proletarianized or deprived of their role in society. And this had an effect on him. And it emboldened him, and he was a bold man already, to think pragmatically, how can we dispense with theoretical formulations and deal practically with the need to modernize China? Mm. Now, every Chinese leader of whatever persuasion, whether the Kangxi Emperor at the end of the 19th century, Sun Yat-sen as the founder of the Republic of China, Chiang Kai-shek as the leader of the Republic of China, Mao Zedong as the leader of the Communist Party, and certainly Zhou Enlai and Deng Xiaoping, had a focus on restoring China to wealth and power. Mm. It had been the wealthiest, the most powerful, arguably, possibly the best governed society on the planet for millennia. And then it was brought low by European imperialism and its Japanese copycats. So the question was, how do we restore our grandeur, as the French would say?
How much of that story do you basically want to confirm? The Middle Kingdom undone by the British Empire.
It was undone by uncouth European imperialists with superior military technology. The Chinese felt, with some justification, that they had been humiliated, marginalized, and indeed China was divided into spheres of influence, agreed between the imperial powers. So the French had Yunnan and Hainan, and the British had other parts of China, and the Russians had some, and the Japanese inherited the German sphere. So the burden of history in China motivates people to want to return the country to excellence. Hmm. And what I am concerned about now, if I may speak of the current moment, is that we in the United States have framed this relationship as one of competition. Competition for wealth, for power. The Chinese are powering ahead with wealth and power. They are powering ahead with investment in research and development and scientific education. Right. At the same time, in the United States, we are disinvesting. The state of California has apparently determined that calculus is too trying for many students and therefore should not be required in high school. The college entrance population in this country is going down, not just as a result of the pandemic, but because of a system which educates no one except through the accumulation of debt. So we are engaged in a competition, and our technique in this marathon is we're going to hamstring the other guy. We're not going to train. We're not going to improve our own performance. We're going to win by bashing the Chinese. That won't work. So this is a great delusion, and it is perhaps as great a delusion as the one we had in 1972, that the Chinese would eternally be backward and weak and vulnerable and therefore needed our protection.
All the way I'm wondering, who left this out of the planning, out of the strategy? Both the hard feelings about the shift of jobs, but the connection between cultures too.
We have a political culture which contains various elements which, when combined, produce this result. First, we have a cult of the warrior, which means that discretionary spending, to the extent it can be, is devoted to the military. It's more a jobs program than related to any identifiable threat. We have a tax system, which is the product of 100 years of lobbying by representatives of groups seeking to close markets to their own benefit. And we have abandoned antitrust policy. So we have an economy which is dominated by oligopolies. This is not an atmosphere that produces the kind of innovation that we used to produce.
Let me add that we're also in love with the slogan, we're number one, that after one American century will come another and another and another. This is pining for Richard Nixon, which I never thought I'd do, but the role of the strategist leader with a vision of the future and some moderately plausible combination of discipline, training, hard work, earning it, has disappeared.
I'm sorry to say that there's a pretty consistent record under our system of electing leaders whose mediocrity outweighs their ability. Now, once in a while, we've been very lucky at crucial moments in our Civil War. Lincoln proved up to the challenges that he faced. I think Nixon, despite his character flaws, proved up to the challenges of adjusting to a world in which the post-World War II order was no longer stable. We had gone through a variety of challenges that should have awakened us to the need for change. One of them was the Cuban Missile Crisis. We put missiles in Turkey, not announcing it. The Russians noticed, and the Soviet Union put missiles in Cuba. And then we had a very frightening moment for both sides. That should have told us something about the kind of foreign policy we needed. And I think it did tell Nixon something. You know, one can disparage him for many reasons, but let's not forget that in addition to foreign policy innovation, most notably the opening to China, the detente with the Soviet Union,
right,
beginnings of arms control. He also was the founder of the National Endowment for the Humanities, and for the arts.
And the Environmental Protection Agency.
And the Environmental Protection Agency. So this was somebody who was able to see farther than most and prepared to act on his vision. We haven't seen much of that. When was the last time that the world looked with anticipation at an American president speaking to the UN General Assembly?
Hmm.
Have we put forward initiatives? Or are we now in a defensive mode, critical of others, self-righteous about ourselves, and no longer, as we did in the 19th century, to a great advantage, no longer in search of best practices abroad that we can learn from and adopt?
I never forget that you were recommended, shortlisted to be Barack Obama's chief of all intelligence in the White House. Didn't come to pass, but I keep wondering what we lost with your advice to the chief executive across the board. Call this a makeup session. I'm especially struck now at the difference in the way you read the rivalry with China in this moment. And your most striking argument is, put the old Cold War with the Russians entirely out of your head. This is nothing like it. Spell that out. The big differences here between Russia, which, as other people notice, is pretty self-sufficient at its level of consumption. It has oil, it has farmland. They can survive on their own, thank you, if they had to. China has grown rich and incredibly powerful in a deep relationship with our economy, not exactly with our people, but with our banking system, our trade system.
You remind me of a remark that Henry Kissinger once made, which was that
Kissinger and I making the same observation?
Absolutely. He noted that China had gotten along quite well without the United States for 4,000 years.
True.
And perhaps we should not be trying to tell the Chinese how to organize themselves or behave.
Speak to the notion in a lot of our minds that NATO is to the old Cold War with Russia as those friendly nations of East Asia are in what could be a new Cold War with China. Japan, Australia, Taiwan, Philippines, Indonesia, the people that we want to protect against China.
Well, NATO started, of course, as a defensive reaction against the Soviet establishment of control in Eastern Europe. If you look at East Asia, it's quite different. First of all, there is no unifying culture in Asia as there is in Europe. Europeans may speak different languages, but they have a common heritage in Christendom and Catholicism, Protestantism, a common history focused on religion. a common capitalist system. If you look at East Asia, that is not the case. You have a diversity of countries that is really quite remarkable. These countries, all of them, have their own identity. All of them, since the end of World War II, when there was a vacuum in the region, the Japanese overthrew European imperialism and American imperialism, got us out of the Philippines. We then overthrew Japanese imperialism and returned to the area as the exerciser of primacy. And we've been there ever since. After World War II, these countries didn't amount to much. The per capita income in Korea, where we fought a war, was $50 a year. Japan was a basket case. The Philippines was nowhere near as cohesive and prosperous as it is now, not to say that it's terribly prosperous. Indonesia had been torn apart by both the Japanese and a rebellion against Dutch rule. Indochina, the same. So there was a sort of a vacuum, and it was natural for us to fill it. There's no vacuum now. Japan is the third largest economy in the world. It has a formidable, undeclared military. South Korea is the most educated society on the planet. 86% of South Korean high school graduates go on to university. Unheard of. It is also one of the most innovative societies anywhere, which is why Korean technology is so widespread. Southeast Asians have got ASEAN. They figured out a formula for coexistence and cooperation, and there is no vacuum. So this is the difference. When we say to people in Asia, you must join us in confronting China, they say, well, wait a minute, China's our largest trading partner. We have a historical relationship with China. We don't want to fight with China. We don't even want you to fight with China. We want to reach a stable accommodation with China as a rising power. We'd welcome your backing for that, but we don't want to have a war. So the Taiwan issue is at the center of this, of course. Japan has a strategic interest in Taiwan, but even it has been extremely cautious about indicating what it would do in the event of a war in the Taiwan Strait. Europeans don't want a war with Russia. Asians don't want a war with China. We seem to want to be able to conduct a war with either or both.
One last thought on the old Cold War and what is sometimes called a new one with China. It is said that the arms race with the Soviets over a long period of time was what destroyed the country, what won the war. We bankrupted them with the arms race. How does that play out in relation to us in China?
The problem with China is that they are spending much less than 2% of their GDP on the military.
Right.
We are spending considerably more than that. We don't have an integrated defense budget, so we can't tell exactly how much we're spending, but it's something well over $1 trillion, and it is probably something like 5% of our GDP.
But in short, the Cold War thinking could bankrupt us sooner than China.
That is exactly the point. The Chinese have a resilience and surge capacity in the military area that we don't. And it's worse than that. The Chinese have the shipbuilding capacity that we had in World War II. We don't have it. We don't have the ability to readjust our economy for a long-term military struggle with a great power like China. You can look at China and say, well, any increase in the Chinese economy, let's say more automobile production, of course the Chinese are now the world's largest automobile producers and market, you know, well, this is producing factories that could be converted to tank production, which is what happened in World War II in the United States. So this is a justification for more military spending here and for more antagonism to China, and that suits our defense contractors very well. These companies are operating on a cost-plus basis. The waste and the fraud and the mismanagement are notorious. It's no accident that the U.S. defense budget has never been successfully audited. Here we are. We borrow $1 trillion every year just to keep our government operating before we do anything new. And we're going to take on a country that has a pretty balanced budget, a trade surplus, an industrial economy twice as large as ours, a scientific, technological, engineering, and mathematical workforce that is a fourth of the world already and growing in proportion. And we're going to do this while investing nothing, piling up more debt, and lowering standards for education? I don't think so. So I am not concerned about China in this competition. Mm. It seems to be taking care of itself. I'm concerned about us. I would like to see a return, as you suggested, to someone with vision and statesmanship, someone who knows how to look at the future and deflect it in desirable directions. I mean, I think it's very striking. Here we have a looming crisis, a possible war, according to both Chinese and American strategists, over Taiwan. And the only debate in the United States is about whether to make our ambiguous commitment to Taiwan clear. There is no one saying, how do we solve this problem? Not one person.
Coming up, Chaz Freeman will tell you the world is waiting for a new Nixon. This is Open Source. So Nixon to China hasn't worked out perfectly for the United States, but maybe not for China either. My best friend in China writes to me this week about the long aftermath of the mind meld in Beijing. The Chinese dream today, he says, is to get a Western degree, steal Western technology to bring back to China, get rich here by exploiting cheap labor and lax environmental standards, and enjoy this easy money abroad. In other words, China's new middle class is turning China into an American colony. They take away China's wealth and resources, leaving behind debt, pollution, and inequality for the Communist Party to clean up. Chaz Freeman, speak of the hard feelings and cultural losses on both ends of this breakthrough.
Well, your friend might very well be describing the U.S. at the end of the 19th century. Americans stole a lot of European technology, took advantage of immigration, sweatshops, to make a lot of money, and then retired, if they could, to a place like Italy or the south of France.
The textile revolution in Lowell, Massachusetts.
There you are.
Exactly that way. Chaz, range as wide as you want about something missing in this relationship, including affection and closeness and cultural give back, Chinese books, music.
Well, this relationship is not deep. At the moment, it's going very badly. Americans, by a very large percentage, are either suspicious of or hostile to Chinese, and the Chinese now mirror those attitudes in thinking about us. What could fix this?
Before you fix it, at what point did it go sour? Did you say, no, this isn't what we planned or thought of or dreamed of?
The U.S.-China relationship has had its ups and downs almost on a decade-to-decade basis. Just to take some examples, in the 1930s, the United States was entranced with Burl Buck's novels and the stalwart Chinese peasantry, and we were engaged in what we considered to be very generous charity to the starving Chinese. In the 1940s, the Chinese were our allies against Japan. Franklin Delano Roosevelt actually imagined that under Chiang Kai-shek, China was a democracy. Hmm. Nothing could have been farther from the truth. In the 1950s, after the Korean War and the Chinese Revolution, we were completely estranged, had no communication, and the American view of China was of, as someone put it, the empire of the blue ants, all Chinese wearing blue boiler suits, and supposedly conformist.
And we were pointing fingers at each other about who lost China.
Well, of course. But anyway, to go on, in the 1960s, we discovered China as a strategic bulwark against the Soviet Union. In the 1970s, we opened a relationship. Both sides were overcome with curiosity and the wonderful experience of encountering a different reality than the one we had imagined in each place. In the 1980s, Chinese began to come to the United States in very large numbers. became a major force in our universities. And we, as the hosts of such people, had a huge effect on Chinese policy and the evolution of Chinese society. McDonald's got into China.
And the National Basketball Association.
Well, indeed. And in the 1990s, we began with an attempt to change China, to impose our standards of politics and human rights on China by denying China trade rights. When that failed, we changed course, but we remained, after Tiananmen, 1989, we remained rather cold toward China and the Chinese. After the year 2000, 2001, we had one of our spy planes and a Chinese jet crash together, and China began to be the enemy of choice for Pentagon war planning. And that was interrupted by 9/11, where instead of having an imaginary high-tech enemy in China, we had a real low-tech enemy in Al-Qaeda. In the second decade of the 21st century, we went through a cycle which ended with the Trump administration, now carried on by the Biden administration, where we seem to have forgotten all the standards of diplomacy. I think this was epitomized at Anchorage when Secretary of State Blinken and others met with their Chinese counterparts. And essentially, they went into the meeting and they said, "You are miscreants. You are morally reprehensible. If we can, we will hold you down. We consider you to be adversaries. But, you know, there are one or two things we'd like you to do for us. Would you be willing to do them?" This is the sort of approach that guarantees a hostile reaction.
Come back to an assignment list for the new Nixon, but start, please, with the climate crisis. An obvious invitation for China and the United States, both huge polluters, both with advanced scientific establishments. What would prevent the new Nixon from going to Beijing again and saying, "Mr. Xi, we're going to work on this together"? Equally, could have been COVID, could be nuclear proliferation, but something appropriately huge and unexpected.
I think you're exactly right. All of the issues you mentioned, that is climate change, non-proliferation, scientific advance, the regulation of global trade so that it promotes prosperity rather than redistributes it, and the management of great power relations, all of these things are urgent requirements, but they lack the concreteness and the urgency of the Cold War's rivalries. So we're focused very much on things that are not helpful in the context of getting along with great countries like China, Russia, I would add India, Japan, the EU, and perhaps Latin America. All these are troubled relationships at the moment.
Start with Taiwan. You've written that, in fact, it's been a very successful policy to keep Taiwan somehow in the background, call it one China in two different places, but keep making up words, in effect, to defer a conflict. Today, China is much stronger than it was 10, 15, 20 years ago in terms of being able to settle the matter militarily. And the interesting new wrinkle that I learned from you is that younger Taiwanese are ready to say goodbye to China. It's not a fighting cause in the great mass of Taiwan. Speak to how you get out of that vice, but also just the very thought that it could come to war with the United States and China.
First, our Taiwan policy has been a tremendous success. We broke relations with Taiwan. We de-recognized it as a state. We withdrew our forces from it. We ended our defense commitment to it. And yet, it has democratized. It has a robust democracy with a great respect for civil liberty. It is prosperous above European levels. It has been enormously successful in areas of high technology like chip manufacture. All of these things have happened despite the absence of a normal U.S.-Taiwan relationship. I'd say that's a hell of a success. However, the policy, which was diplomatic, of finessing the Taiwan question to give people on both sides of the Taiwan Strait, in Taipei and Beijing, time to reach an accommodation, did not work. Why did it not work? Well, no doubt there are many reasons. Some of them have to do with the increasingly unattractive nature of the political system on the mainland. Some of them have to do with the forging of a separate Taiwan-Chinese identity in Taiwan through democracy. We have come to a point where Beijing looks at this and says, the United States has gone back on all of its promises. Taiwan has declared independence in all but name. The United States is increasing its defense commitment to Taiwan and thereby emboldening Taiwan to continue on the course to independence. And we have to make a choice. The choice is now between imposing reunification either through a coercive negotiation or through the use of force, or betraying the main objective of both Chinese revolutions in the 20th century, 1911 and 1949, both of which aimed to unify China, eliminate foreign spheres of influence on Chinese soil, and eliminate warlordism, meaning local armed forces in a state of confrontation with the central government. Mm. So Chinese nationalism is being challenged in a way that makes a bloody rendezvous by us with it more likely rather than less.
Bloody rendezvous is an understatement. It could be a nuclear war. So many nightmares in that list of traps, Chaz, but two things. What is this itch in our military policy, in our blood, in our something for a disaster with China? Why isn't the sheer terror at the thought of a disastrous war drive us into an alternative relationship?
Why does the United States not focus on the risk? I think there are quite a number of reasons for that. One is hubris. Despite the fact that we've lost every war we've fought since the end of World War II, with the exception of the Gulf War, where I claim a part, we lost it politically, we won it militarily. Despite that, we have an unbounded faith in the capacity of our military to prevail. Second, generations have gone on. The nuclear allergy, which kept us from seriously thinking, for example, about the tactical use of nuclear weapons on the battlefield, has essentially disappeared. We don't seem to have come to grips with the fact that our homeland is no longer sacrosanct. 9/11 should have taught us that we need to be concerned about retaliation. I don't think anybody can win a war over Taiwan. Certainly, if there is one, Taiwan will be destroyed. Very likely, Chinese prosperity and accomplishments, industrial accomplishments, will be set back by us. We might very well end up losing quite a number of cities. And why should we do this? My contention is that we need to sober up people in Taiwan. The cavalry is not going to arrive. Their fate is in their own hands, and it can only be achieved, that is, their objective, like ours, I assume, should be for them to retain their democratic system and their autonomy to the extent they can, their relationships on a practical level with foreign societies, the openness of their own culture, while they reach an accommodation with China. And this is not impossible, but it cannot be done by Americans. It can only be done, as the Shanghai Communique says, by the Chinese themselves, meaning people in Taiwan, people in the mainland. And at the moment, Taiwan has no incentive to negotiate, to have talks. In fact, it's broken off talks. There were talks under the previous government in Taiwan. This government is pro-independence and has denied the basic premise for the previous negotiations, which was there's only one China and we need to find a way to accommodate each other within it. That's gone. Now Taiwan says, no, no, we can't talk about that. So what they want to talk about is independence, which the mainland won't talk about. So there's an impasse. If there's no talk, there can be no solution. So the United States should be doing not telling the Taiwanese what to say, not turning our backs on them, but making it clear to them their options are limited and we will support them to the extent they try to reach an accommodation with the other side of the strait. And we will not support them if they do things that end up getting us into a war where no U.S. national security interests other than our pride are at stake. So there is room for statecraft. There is room for concessions. There is a room for thinking about short-term compromise in the interest of long-term gain. We need to rediscover these things. If you're all-powerful, you don't have to compromise. But we're no longer all-powerful. We need to rethink a lot of things. This is where Nixon came in. He was a flawed personality, but he was a statesman, and he was prepared to make major adjustments in policy to fit changed circumstances. He had fought bravely in World War II. He was the closest Republican of stature to Joe McCarthy in the 1950s. And yet, like Mao Zedong, he, who was equally extremist, he was able to rise to the occasion when he saw that the national interest demanded it. Where are such people in our political system at present?
Last question. Xi Jinping, the Mao of our time, imagine what he feels he owes to the spirit of 1972.
He is a complex man, as you would expect. He's obviously both very bright and shrewd. His experience in 1972, or the 70s, was to have been rusticated, put down on the farm, theoretically to help the peasants. His father was victimized by the Cultural Revolution, persecuted, later emerged as a great reformer. Xi Jinping seems to have come out of this, according to Chinese friends, and I don't know, she personally have shaken hands with him, but that's about all, seems to have come out of this as a bit of a control freak. When you talk to Chinese who are not admiring of Xi Jinping, and there are many who are not, they will tell you that he is a representative of his Cultural Revolution generation, and that the answer is to wait him out, because in due course, he will be gone.
But if somebody, the man on the street, would ask Xi Jinping, by the way, Mr. Chairman, what do we think about that breakthrough in 72? What do we owe it? What's his short answer?
I think he would say it was very beneficial to China, that it was a wise strategic decision by Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai, that it did not solve all problems, but it set in motion developments that could help solve problems, that there's no way around dealing with the United States, and that, as he has said frequently, in dealing with the United States, China should put cooperation first and competition second.
Interesting.
We, of course, reverse the order. We put animosity or competition first and only then admit we might cooperate on a thing or two. I think Xi Jinping has the order right.
Charles Freeman, such a treat. I so wish Barack Obama had you as his intelligence chief. When I get there, you'll be mine.
Well, you'll have to do a really hard job of recruiting. I did not want that job, and I was greatly relieved when I was able to go back to a private life with freedom of speech to say what I want rather than what the government wants me to say.
Thank you for doing it yet again with us.
You're most welcome.
Chaz Freeman became the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia in a long career in diplomacy and intelligence. He keeps writing and speaking just what he thinks at his website, Chaz Freeman, that's chasfreeman.net. And stick with Open Source in the coming weeks to hear our series, In Search of Monsters, in collaboration with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Our show this week was produced by Mary McGrath and Adam Coleman, with engineering help from the WBUR production team. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source. Listeners, You can continue this conversation with us on a new platform we're experimenting with called Clubhouse. Download the Clubhouse app on your phone and join us there Sunday night, February 13th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. We will all be talking with the China Watcher and rock star Kaiser Guo, podcast legend in two cultures. Join us Sunday at 8. Go to Clubhouse, look for the room marked Radio Open Source, and we'll see you there. Open Source is a proud member of Hub and Spoke, a collective of smart, thoughtful, independent podcasts. If you're already nostalgic for Christmas 2021 or looking forward to Christmas 2022, check out the latest episode of the Hub and Spoke show, Iconography. Host Charles Gustine brings back a beloved and newly remastered 2016 episode about Charles Dickens's timeless story, A Christmas Carol. It's called Ebenezer Scrooge. You'll find it at iconographypodcast.com. And you can check out the whole Hub and Spoke lineup at hubspokeaudio.org.